Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. This is going to be one of those Vermont Viewpoint shows that gives you insight into several different subjects, from suffrage to local media to labor disputes in the 1930s Vermont to hyperbaric oxygen therapy. So strap in, because here we go. Last year marked the 100th anniversary of the adoption of the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. So 2020 was going to be huge, and the League of Women Voters of Vermont planned a great celebration. And then the COVID. Not to be deterred, remember, women fought long and hard for the vote. The celebration was postponed until this Saturday. The event is called Hard Won, Not Done, Voting Matters. And here to talk about the suffrage movement and this weekend's event is Marguerite Edelman. Marguerite is on the board of directors of the League of Women Voters, Vermont, and a member of the Vermont Suffrage Centennial Alliance Executive Committee. Marguerite, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much, Rick. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, it's great having you. And we have Sandy Dooley. She's a member of the VSCA Executive Committee as well. Sandy, thank you for being here.
I'm delighted. Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, listeners, if you want to ask our guests about the suffrage movement or about Saturday's event, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Marguerite, can you give us a little history of the women's suffrage movement leading up to the passage of the 19th Amendment?
Actually, I'm going to turn that question over to my colleague,
okay,
Sandy.
Okay, excellent. Sandy, that question's for you.
Okay, well, most people point to 1848, which was the Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls, New York, and that was when the Declaration of Rights and Sentiments was it had been written and was endorsed by the convention. And then it was 72 long years until 1920, when the 36th state, which was Tennessee, adopted the suffrage amendment, and it went to Washington and was added to the Constitution. So, and Vermont was not a key player in that history. Actually, some of the most progressive areas of the country were in the West. Because of a governor who was opposed to suffrage for women, we missed the opportunity to be this 36th state. But it's a long story, and there's a lot in the Suffrage Alliance's website about that, which is vtsuffrage2020.org.
All right.
If you want to know a little bit about how the League got involved with this celebration, two women who really think ahead went to the Vermont Commission on Women in late 2017 and said, hey, we've got to get started on a celebration of the centennial. The commission said, we're really not in a position to take that on right now, but we suggest you go to the League of Women Voters, who very happily agreed to take on the leadership role, and they did a lot of outreach, assembled the alliance that has over 60 members, including organizations and individuals, and things got started.
Oh, that's fantastic. Marguerite, who makes up that alliance, the Vermont Suffrage Centennial Alliance?
It is quite a wide variety of individuals and groups across the state. Once again, Sandy probably has that at her fingertips and can give you more information.
Sandy, back to you.
Okay. Well, there are the Peace and Justice Center, the ACLU, the NAACP, the law school, a number of colleges, and, of course, the League of Women Voters of Vermont is in the forefront. The business and professional women, just a wide variety of organizations, plus some of the several government entities, the Historical Society, Vermont Humanities. Anyway, that's all on our website also.
All right. And again, that website is vtsuffrage2020.org. Marguerite, I'm going to try one more time. Why do you think it's important for today's women to understand the struggles that women before them went through to finally be given that ability to vote?
Well, I would say all people need to understand this struggle, because voting is the foundation of our democracy. And we need to understand the past struggles, the mistakes that we made in the past, the people that we excluded from that struggle. And we need to look at the present and see what's happening today that, again, is causing individuals not to be able to vote easily or freely within our democratic society. So to me, it's highly relevant to understand the strategies and the struggle and the compromises, sometimes not such good compromises, that were made to get us the 19th Amendment, and then, you know, where things are today. I think it will always be a continual struggle to keep expanding voting rights and to make it easy for everyone to vote.
What were those compromises that were made?
Well, many marginalized individuals were left out. Native Americans weren't even considered citizens, for example, so they didn't get their right to vote with the 19th Amendment. In addition, blacks and other minorities were not included, each state had the ability then to make its own kind of guidelines, which once again excluded individuals from the right to vote. Even the suffrage movement itself, which was predominantly controlled by white women, despite the fact that women of color and other women were, you know, a huge force in fighting for the right to vote, were eventually excluded. So those are things that we need to recognize in the compromises that were made that were not acceptable. And that's what we hope to do, actually, this Saturday, is to really recognize as many of the women and groups that struggled for the right to vote and many of the issues that we've overlooked and that will probably keep reemerging in our society.
Sandy, have women advanced far enough in politics 101 years after being able to vote?
Well, my feeling is that until we have about 50% of women in the legislature and representing us, in offices, that hasn't happened yet. We still see women, for the most part, they've certainly advanced. They're certainly holding more political office and helping in that respect, but we still are not where we should be in terms of representation, and that includes diversity as well. Sandy, do you want to add anything?
Well, the one thing I wanted to mention was, in addition to blacks and indigenous people and other people of color, people with disabilities didn't really get the protections they needed to have full access to the ballot box until 1990 with the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So it really does go on. With regard to women, Vermont is the only state that has not sent either a female representative or senator to the United States Congress. So while we do have an admirable record, there's still a long way to go. But everybody is, the important thing is to keep working at it.
Well taken. Marguerite, tell us about the event that is happening in Montpelier on Saturday on the Statehouse lawn.
We are so excited about this event. We had a wonderful planning committee, diverse planning committee, that looked at what we wanted to be the themes for our event in Montpelier from 3 to 5 on the Statehouse lawn. And we started looking for speakers who would match up well with the themes that we wanted to be brought forward. And those themes were enfranchisement, non-citizen voting, queer inclusion, and municipal voting, local voting. We wanted to make sure that those were covered by many of the speakers that we had. So our keynote speaker is Annette Gordon-Reed, and Sandy can tell you quite a bit about Annette, and we are so pleased to have her as our headliner.
That's great. Sandy, go right ahead. I'd love to hear about Annette.
Annette Gordon-Reed is a law professor and a historian. She's also a Texas native. She sort of burst on the national scene in 2008 when her book, The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family, was published and subsequently was recognized with the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award for History. She will be, we are so fortunate to have her in Vermont. She will be, her talk is called Voting in Texas, 156 Years of Struggle. And it really explores what happened after Black Texans got the right to vote on Juneteenth in 1865 and the denial of those rights during the Jim Crow period and then the continuing fight for voting rights that exists today, and that's right up to the very day where they're trying to pass a, what I would call a negative voting bill that will make it more difficult for Texans, especially Texans of color and other groups to vote.
Sandy, how disappointing was it not to be able to hold the event last year because of the pandemic?
It was a tremendous disappointment, but the main thing was that we were all in this together. I mean, all Vermonters, all Americans, things went got put on hold. We shifted our focus to we made things virtual or online. Our 5K event became virtual, and then we really focused on voting and promoting voting registration and voting in the primary and in the November election. So voting is the heart of suffrage, and it's the heart of the birth of the League of Women Voters and their ongoing work. So while it was a disappointment, we carried on.
Boy, you know, you just brought that up. At the closing, you know, kind of years of getting the amendment passed, we had the pandemic then, the Spanish flu pandemic, and now the centennial, another pandemic. Will there be protocols in place on Saturday there at the event?
There will be nothing more than what the governor recommends, but we will encourage, we'll remind people that everyone that's unvaccinated should, we ask, to wear a mask, and we would encourage anyone that chooses to practice social distancing. It's an outdoor event, so that's not required, but we certainly encourage that.
Perfect. Let's take a call. We've got Rich joining us from Huntington. Rich, how you been?
Good morning, Rick. Good morning to your guests.
Morning.
You know, people are still lamenting the fact that Vermont is the last state in the union to have never sent a woman to Congress. And I think that's a little disingenuous because we have had the opportunity in the past to send a woman to Congress. Most recent example is we had a very qualified woman who would have made an excellent representative to Congress by the name of Martha Rainville.
Yep.
But instead of sending a woman to Congress, we sent another attorney. And that's who we have in there right now. So let's not forget about the fact that we have had plenty of opportunity to do so.
Well, that was back in 06, though, Rich. But your point is well taken, and I appreciate that call. Martha Rainville and Peter Welch in what probably was the finest election, you know, as far as civility as we'll ever see. Unfortunately, Martha left the state, moved to Washington, and no longer a Vermonter, because it would have been great to see Martha in politics, run again, and like Rich said, you know, would have been a really great representative for this state. Marguerite, you know, how do we encourage, how do we make sure that there are enough women coming through the ranks, you know, taking part in politics, whether it be on the municipal level, the state level, and hopefully on the national level here for Vermont?
Well, one of the ways is that we need to see women in these positions of power and in government and in legislators. And, you know, we're starting to see that. Mm-hmm. We're starting to actually realize, I think young girls especially, when they look at Kamala Harris, say, hey, that could be me. Why not me? But we haven't, you know, for many years had enough examples and role models where we could say, yes, that could be me. There are now organizations and groups that are trying to promote women running for office and diverse individuals running for office. And I think within our democracy, that's a very good thing.
Mm-hmm. Sandy, let's talk about Saturday's event, Hard Won, Not Done, Voting Matters. What is the significance of that title, the title of the event?
The significance is that all of the struggles for voting rights have been hard and have required the efforts of many people and new techniques. For example, the women, they were called the Silent Sentinels, who demonstrated outside the White House when President Wilson was president in 1919 to get his support. That was the first time people demonstrated outside the White House, and that was a very unusual role for women. Women also had protest marches, and very large ones and well-attended ones. One of the leaders of the suffrage movement at that time, Alice Paul, was brilliant in terms of how to use the media available at that time to get public support. And then the other thing is, it's like there's always work to be done. Last year we had the pandemic and it was going to make voting so much more difficult for everybody. People didn't want to necessarily go into a polling place. They didn't want to stand close in line to somebody. So all of these measures were passed to make it really easy, more easy than ever before to vote. And then there was all that participation. And then we've gotten the pushback that some people aren't so happy with all that voter participation. So I think struggle is one of the best words about maintaining, expanding, and pushing forward the right to vote.
And Sandy, what do you hope people attending on Saturday will come away with from the event?
One of the things is that Saturday's event is not all speeches. Mm-hmm. And we have a woman reading a poem, her own poem. We have a land dedication by a Native American individual. We have a well-known vocalist, Nicole Nelson, and we have an artist who's already started a painting to commemorate the centennial that she'll be working on there. So some people call this creative speech, and that is that you can experience messages in a variety of forms. But I think the message is we want people to be inspired, but also to recognize the importance of voting and the importance of really paying attention to what's going on across the country, because voting rights in Vermont are really, really some of the best, if not the best, in the country.
Mm-hmm. Marguerite, we have about a minute left, but we had a call yesterday from one of our listeners, Fred in Newbury, and he asked this question, and he asked if I thought voters should be required to show proof of a COVID vaccination before being allowed to vote. And I wondered what your thoughts, being part of the League of Women Voters, thought about that idea.
Well, it's certainly an interesting concept, but I think that we would have to bow to our State Department of Health here in Vermont and to what is being recommended within the state. I mean, certainly somebody who's unvaccinated should be wearing a mask when they go to vote. And if the pandemic, you know, continues, this resurgence of the Delta variant, we might see some changes in our state recommendations. But if we care about other people and other individuals, you know, my hope is that, you know, we'll be following whatever recommendations are made by our Department of Public Health. And I'm sure they'll have something to say about that.
I'm sure they will. That's Marguerite Edelman. She's on the board of directors of the League of Women Voters and a member of the Vermont Suffrage Centennial Alliance Executive Committee. And we've also been speaking with Sandy Dooley. She's a member of the VSCA Executive Committee as well. Listeners, for more information about hard-won, not-done voting matters, you can visit vtsuffrage2020.org. Marguerite, Sandy, thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care. We're going to get a CBS News update, and then we're going to hear about the work of the Community News Service. And coming up at 1 o'clock today on WDEV, we've got the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. That's followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with our very own Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Newspapers have had a hard time since the internet and social media became parts of our everyday lives. But the importance of having a media source in small towns and villages to report what's happening in municipal offices and at select board meetings remains an important check on the system. UVM Center for Research on Vermont identified this situation and also looked at the students who had an interest in journalism and local politics and were hungry for some experience. And thus, the Community News Service had legs. Here to talk about it is Corey Dawson. He's editor of the Community News Service. Corey, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And Luke Vidic is a graduate of UVM and the Community News Service. He now writes for the Barton Chronicle. Luke, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, and thanks for having me.
You're most welcome. Listeners, if you've got questions for our guests, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Corey, explain what the Community News Service is.
Sure. So it's essentially a project that has two missions. One is to train students like who Luke just once was to learn about their communities and to tell the stories, as you said, of local politics, local select boards, get them the understanding of what a local journalist does. And it's also to help these small papers, many of whom have lost reporters over the years, to do their work, and to help fill, you know, this help fill what we call news deserts. This is a term that has sprung up in recent years as news organizations have been really decimated, financially speaking. And, you know, a big part of this program is getting students that understanding, but also just very much getting these papers, the content that they need, getting these people the stories that they need, and getting, at the end of the day, readers the information they need to make good decisions about their lives.
When did the service get started? And in that time, can you give us an estimate of how many UVM students have gained journalism experience through the service?
Sure. So it started in 2019, in the fall of 2019, and so we're coming up on 2 years. And I would say we've got about 200 students thus far who've come through, I believe. And that number has grown from, you know, five the first year to 50 last semester in the spring.
Oh, that is really impressive. Luke, from a student's perspective, what did that experience entail for you?
Yeah, so it, where to begin? So it was, so my semester was a bit interesting. I don't think it paints the best picture of the program since I was doing it last spring in the middle of the pandemic.
Oh, right.
And working as a journalist during that time was a bit, it was very electronic. It was all virtual.
Sure.
But I still had tons of experiences and chances to talk with local town leaders, to learn, you know, the ins and outs of local government, because that ends up being a lot of what small town reporting is about. But then I also would get to speak with local businesses. I was covering the Jericho area, and so I did a piece on Bolton, and I spoke with their president. I did a recap of their season. And you sort of learn, I think, how to ask the right questions and to find a story somewhere where otherwise you just, you know, when you're not a journalist, you just glaze over and ignore some little details.
Yeah, what were some of the key things that you learned, you know, for your journalism career that you're now, you know, well on your way, that you picked up as part of being in the community news service?
Yeah, I'd say the biggest thing you pick up is that being a journalist, more than anything, is just about being a people person. The ability to write is, of course, a necessity, and that's something that I practiced as a part of the community news service. But ultimately, the most interesting, the things that will grab a reader aren't necessarily how you write, but what you're writing about. And the way you get that is just by knowing people, hearing conversations, and being a part of local discussions. So, and I think that's something I picked up on as a part of the community news service, where I learned that, you know, as someone from Pennsylvania, that's me trying to write about Jericho, Vermont, a place I had really almost never visited. And because it was during the pandemic, I couldn't really do much visiting.
Oh.
Because of all that, I mean, I sorry, losing my train of thought here. I learned that the way you get these stories and the way you learn about a region is just by talking to people. And I think that's something that's come more into play since coming up here to the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont.
Yeah.
That the way I get my stories these days are just by, you know, I see someone at the local general store and we have a 10-minute conversation. And by the end of it, he's telling me about how he thinks his boss is embezzling money or something like that.
Mm.
You know?
Yep. Corey, explain what your role is as editor with the Community News Service.
So, in a way, it's a lot of a catch-all. So, we work with you know, up to 20 papers when we have a full roster. So, a lot of that is, you know, working with them, understanding what their needs are. You know, just to give you one example, you know, we work with the Williston Observer. The editor at that paper is really interested in covering very much the town select board and town government, mm-hmm. and he's really good at it. So the reporter that we send there is mostly interested in doing, and they need, you know, business profiles, features of folks in town to help fill out the paper and to let, you know, that editor focus on that role. And it's different with every single paper. And so, you know, oftentimes, my reporters will be sending me stories, and I give them an edit. I work with them on, you know, finding a story, figuring out who to call, and, you know, working with them on writing with clarity and for a general audience, which is really something that they don't, you know, have right away. You know, most of the students, and I'm sure Luke can attest to this, is, you know, You're writing for a professor, right?
Right.
You know, these students have to learn and learn quickly to write for a general audience. So, you know, that is one massive part of what I do. And then the other part is obviously training. And, you know, I do a weekly, you know, very, you know, skills-based seminar with my students. And we talk, you know, initially about the role of a reporter, the ethics behind what you're doing, And, you know, one thing I really try to instill in people is that when you're writing for, as a contributor, essentially, for all these papers, you know, nobody except for your mom is reading the byline, right? So you have to act and you know, write and report and conduct yourself with the same level of professionalism as a professional reporter. Mm-hmm. And I think by and large, you know, our reporters with our help, you know, really step up to the plate there.
Oh, well done. Now, Luke, you graduated from UVM and from the Community News Service to now writing with the Barton Chronicle. So what has been the most interesting part of the job for you so far?
I was speaking with another reporter about this the other day. I'd say it's just the way that when you work as a reporter, there's this sort of, we called it a crust of a conversation that you can just break through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're a normal person, you can't just go walking up to someone on the street and start by just asking them a question. But I found these days I can walk up to anyone and say, hi, my name's Luke. I'm a reporter. What can you tell me about this? Right away, and I mean immediately, anyone will answer any question you have, and it's fun, I think, to have a freedom that not many people get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the excuse to be able to just call someone up or walk up to them and begin that conversation and stand there and take notes, and you're allowed to do that as a reporter. What specifically has the Community News Service provided you that you've called upon in the new job so far?
Oh, it's hard to say because I think the new job, I've been learning a lot. Again, I had my experience with the Community News Service was largely virtual. And, you know, these days that's kind of, that's sort of faded away.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're largely in person these days. So I'd say the thing that I think stuck with me the most from the Community Service that I've taken with me is just how to carry yourself as a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And a reporter, you know, when you're in a conversation with someone who you've never met before and who might not be super happy to talk to you, just to have the confidence and to be stalwart and just continue on with what is your job. I think that was something that I got a taste of in the Community News Service, and I've been able to then expand upon now writing for the Barton Chronicle.
And we're now joined by Lisa Scalotti of the Waterbury Roundabout. And I think Lisa knows the Community News Service quite well. Lisa, good morning. Welcome to the show. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Rick. Yes, thanks for taking my call. Hi, Corey and Luke.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Lisa. How's it going?
How has the Community News Service been involved in the Roundabout?
Well, I'm thrilled to hear you guys talking about this morning because it was a really big part of what I'm doing right now. And, you know, a little over a year ago, I couldn't even imagine what I'm doing. So there's been so much happening during the pandemic on the local news scene. It's been a time when people have really needed local news, and it's been a really tough time for local news with the just the business closed downs and all the impacts on local news operations having, you know, less revenue to play with. They've really been stretched for staff, and the Community News Service has been able to, like Corey was saying, kind of help fill that gap. Basically, I was with the Community News Service in the beginning when we started. It was actually the summer of 2019 was our first group that we had.
Wow.
And I was still working in weekly newspapers. And the Community News Service students were able to sort of feed stories to some of these weekly papers in Chittenden County. That's where they began. And they were essentially filling that gap from the beginning. And then the pandemic hit a little over a year, or like a year later. And it was when our newspaper here in Waterbury folded. And the newspaper chain there that had our paper, the Waterbury Record, had to cut back. And they folded the Waterbury Record, and it was a really bad time to be without local news. And that's how the Community News Service group was able to sort of turn its attention to Waterbury. And our website, if you look at it, was designed by one of the Community News Service students who, you know, basically put that together, and we started doing stories to cover the community here and just dove right in. And it's really great to hear Luke talk about him. I loved his description of having fun talking to people.
Yeah.
And getting stories, and how much, because that's where this hits the ground, right? It's sort of like one reporter at a time, one story at a time, to kind of bring in the next generation to understand how important it is to tell stories of every little town out there, because every town has news, if you ask me. No matter where you look, there's stories everywhere. And so to tell them in a way that connects people and does that responsibly. You know, Corey's job in his seat, he's making sure that these aren't just class assignments that students do. These are going out in real newspapers every week, every month, whatever the circulation is. Mm-hmm. And things have to be, you know, up to those standards. You know, people's names have to be spelled right and facts have to be correct. And right. So there's more at stake in the reporters filing stories for this project than if they were just in a regular class, because it's really going out there and people are relying on it to be professional, for it to be correct, and for it to be accurate. And it's a really, you know, sort of interesting trial by fire experience for them. And it's great to hear, you know, Luke has landed, you know, he's doing it for real every day.
That's so great. Lisa Scalotti of the Waterbury Roundabout, thanks so much for letting us know your experience with the Community News Service. That's great to hear.
Thanks, Rick.
All right,
good luck, everybody.
And, you know, what Lisa is saying, Corey, is what we hear when we do our calls to the various newspapers during the morning news service here and during the afternoon news service here. We are hearing that same kind of feedback of the students and the quality of what they're doing, how they're helping. What papers are using the Community News Service this summer?
This summer, let's see. We've got a long list.
you can kind of give us a general area overview.
Yeah, sure. So it's of course the Roundabout and the Valley Reporter, not too far away. Mm-hmm. We have the Williston Observer, most of the Vermont Community News Group papers. So that's the Shelburne News, the Citizen, Charlotte, and Hinesburg. We also contribute most of all of the news to the Hinesburg Record. We have a reporter at the Hardwick Gazette. We've got one over in the Bradford Journal Opinion, the Heralds of Randolph. Mm-hmm. We've got folks up in Milton, Essex, Colchester. And we also run the Winooski News kind of solely through the Community News Service. It's an outlet that I edit, and I have you know, a few students write for every semester, but that's really the only Winooski-focused outlet, and that's really just us.
Talking to Ray Strong over at the Hardwick Gazette and Tim down at Calibro, down at the White River Valley Herald, they just are so pleased to be able to be linked with Community News Service. Luke, what do you think these newspapers are gaining from the association with the news service?
I think first and foremost, reporters, I mean, it's not a job that a lot of people have the time or ability to take. From what I've learned working alongside other reporters, a lot of times they're doing it as a second or third job, and it's just something they do when they have a free weekend. You know, we have a lot of stringers and not all that many staff writers. So I think just Community News Service provides small papers with the one thing they need, which is people who can write and have the time to do so.
Corey, is this a model for how small town, hyperlocal media outlets will be able to navigate through the media landscape that's been created now in this internet age?
Well, I would say that it's a piece of a puzzle. Mm-hmm. In that we can, you know, and the very talented students that are at UVM and other schools too, can help fill those gaps like we've been talking about. But this is not the solution, as it were, to help, you know, rebuild what we have lost in the past decade, in terms of local journalism. You know, we have lost half of all reporters, in the country. Over the past decade, those jobs are gone. The business model has disappeared. And it is about money at the end of the day, in terms of if we want to rebuild, you know, our journalism infrastructure. You know, we have lost, advertising revenue has been gobbled up by Facebook and Google. The classifieds business has gone to Craigslist. You know, and there is really no one solution to help to make this better. I like to think that we're making a big dent, but and I know that many of the other universities and places that are blessed with the university could very well replicate this model, but that's not everywhere. And I mean, these papers need money, and there's interesting ideas floating around, perhaps even public financing. I would encourage readers to just frankly reach out to your local outlet and just ask how you can support them. I know Lisa, and she was modest for not mentioning it, is starting to accept donations to the Waterbury Roundabout, and they can certainly put it to good use. Consider reaching out to your local paper, consider, even becoming perhaps a 7-day super reader, for example, contributing to other small outlets that can really do big work and big and important work.
Corey, your point's so well taken. We grab this information that we rely on for free, but there is a cost of putting that together and getting that done accurately and quickly and to you. And so do consider supporting these local media that you turn to. Corey Dawson is editor of the Community News Service. Luke Vidic is a graduate of UVM and the Community News Service, and he now writes for the Barton Chronicle. Once again, congratulations, Luke, and thank you both for being on the show this morning.
Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thanks for having us.
Sure thing. Take care. News is next, and then when we return, historian Kevin Thornton will join us to discuss a big labor dispute in Rutland in the 1930s. And it's game two of the Sox home series against the first-place Rays. Our coverage begins tonight at 6:10, first pitch 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. All right, let's shift back into history mode. The last time we had our next guest on, he was regaling us with tales of Thomas Davenport of Forestdale, Vermont, inventor of the electric motor. It was fascinating to hear that history. Today, we're going to head a little bit farther south to the West Rutland of the 1930s when the quarrymen were not happy. Historian Kevin Thornton is researching their travails, and he's here to share what happened. Kevin, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thanks, Rick.
Great to have you. Now, listeners, if you have questions for Kevin or know tales of the striking quarrymen from Rutland County from the 1930s, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Kevin, who were these workers who were working those marble quarries back in the 30s in the Rutland area?
Well, they were employees of the Vermont Marble Company, and they weren't just in West Rutland. The Vermont Marble Company had the strike actually started in Danby. Mm-hmm. There were workers in West Rutland, in Proctor. There was another group in Florence. So all up Route 7, the Marble Valley, the company owned all sorts of resources, and the strike extended all those places as well.
Mm-hmm.
With different effects.
And these workers, where they, we had a lot of wave of immigrants coming from foreign countries to work in granite, marble, slate. Where were these workers from?
Well, one of the really interesting things to me about West Rutland is its ethnic history. That there were, I think, as many as 13 languages spoken in West Rutland in the 1930s, and it was a town of 3,000 people. So they were from all over Europe, I should say. And the latest waves were Eastern Europeans, mm-hmm. and the probably the largest group were Poles.
And what kind of skills did they have?
Well, depends where you were and what jobs they did in the quarries, and that's one of the reasons the strike was as complex as it was, because basically the more skilled workers had the least tendency to strike, and also the workers in Proctor, which was the management town, were less likely to strike. So the guys in the quarries, the latest groups, the newest ethnic groups arriving, tended to have the least skills, but they did know how to create explosions. They had to be very skilled in lifting pieces of marble that weighed, you know, tons out of the quarries that were hundreds of feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
But it was hard physical labor for the most part.
Kevin, there was a lot of socialist and anarchist sentiment with the stonecutters in Barrie, I remember, in the early part of the 20th century. Did these marble workers also harbor those kind of thoughts?
No, I don't think so. It's really a very different atmosphere than Barrie. And I don't know enough about Barrie to be definitive about it, but I think the main difference is that there were small quarries in Barrie. There wasn't one unifying company, and there was an overriding company with marble. And I think that made a huge difference. The workers' grievances tended to be what we expect them to be, about wages, about hours, about safety. But there wasn't any kind of ideological underpinning. There weren't any kind of anarchist, you know, rallies or there wasn't any active socialist party or anything like that in West Rutland.
What were the conditions like for these 1930s quarrymen?
They were really rough. They lived in company housing for the most part. The company was the largest landlord in West Rutland, and that was very significant in the strike. They worked very long hours. They made as little as 36 cents an hour. They were constantly in debt. It was a very, very, very difficult life. And they tended to have large families too, so that made their poverty even harder.
Tell us about whichever Proctor, I'm not sure which one, was in charge, and his role at the time with the Vermont Marble Company.
Well, there are two relevant Proctors. Redfield Jr. was president of the company, but I think the more interesting one is Mortimer. Mortimer Proctor was the last Proctor, the fourth Proctor, to be governor of Vermont in the 1940s. And during the strike, he was the town of Proctor's representative in Montpelier, and he had considerable sway. He would be elected speaker in 1937, Speaker of the House. And he was the company's point man in Montpelier. And one of the really interesting things about the strike and important things about the strike was that the state of Vermont subsidized the company's security. And I think that was largely due to Mortimer's influence.
Hmm. Now, as you mentioned, the strike did eventually spread to, you know, all of where the Vermont Marble Company was, but started down in Danby. Why did it start, and why did it start there?
Well, it was a wildcat strike. It started there, I think, just because probably it was a small, cohesive group of workers. And what started it was an effective wage cut. It was really an hours cut. The company wasn't doing well in the 1930s because of the Depression, and they decided, rather than to fire people, that they would cut everybody's hours. But these workers were already at the absolute minimum for survival. At least they felt that way, and they were, you know, they were had good reason to feel that way, and so they walked out, and within a day so had the rest of the workers, and the real strength of the strike was in West Rutland, and the leadership of the unions had to make the decision of whether we're going to support these guys and sustain a strike, and eventually they did. The company wouldn't budge, so that's what led to a really extended and bitter strike.
This was 1935. I don't know. Did the 40-hour work week exist then, or were they working longer hours and were cut back to something, you know, more?
No, they were working well under 40. That was what they were looking for. They felt that they couldn't survive with the limited hours that they were being offered.
Mm-hmm. And just knowing the history of the Proctors, I can't imagine that they were in a mind to kind of accede to the wishes of the strikers.
No, and they were actually in the stronger position because the company sat on a lot of cash reserves and orders were down. So they could afford to wait out the strikers, and they did. And they played hardball during the strike. It was a very ugly situation.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. You know, what were the actions that were taken against the strikers?
Well, as I said, with the aid of the state, they hired security, and what they did was they hired deputy sheriffs from outside of Rutland County as company security. And there was violence between these deputy sheriffs and strikers on more than one occasion. So there was just the physical intimidation and the danger involved with that. The company also was very active in because it was the largest landlord. The company stopped paying the water bills of strikers. And eventually, and I think this is what really ended the strike, in the spring, they began to evict people. There's stories of company, well, not directly from the company, but there are stories of strikers' families not being allowed any kind of aid from towns, particularly clothes for children during the winter. And in Center Rutland, the overseer of the poor in Center Rutland was a company foreman. So there's that kind of economic pressure. There was the Free Press, sorry, not the Free Press, the Rutland Herald tended mm-hmm. to tilt toward the company and its reporting. And, you know, the main thing was just the poverty and the economic pressure. The strikers really could not afford to stay out.
Boy, as you mention all this, you think of, you know, just last year, payment protection plan, eviction moratoriums, these things not in place in 1935 when all this was going.
Not in place at all in the 1930s, no.
Wow. Kevin, when did things blow up literally and figuratively in this strike?
Well, I'm glad you used the term blow up because there is some... talking about how the strike got ugly, it's really better to be specific. So I'll give you a couple of examples of that. One is that there was an explosion at a railroad bridge between West Rutland and Center Rutland that the company would use to haul marble over. And immediately after that, there were two immigrant Polish workers arrested who were driving down the street in West Rutland. They were arrested because they were out on the street at 2 in the morning after the explosion had happened. And the workers' defense was pretty interesting. One of the things they said was that if we wanted to blow up a bridge, we would know how to do it because we blow things up all the time. And so they were indicating that this was the company trying to make the strikers look bad. And one of the things that buttressed that was that the state's attorney at the time, a guy named Asa Bloomer, who's the state office building in Rutland's named after, Bloomer believed the strikers. He was the only Vermont politician that tilted toward the strikers during the strike. And during the trial of these two guys who were accused of blowing up the bridge, he put one of the sheriffs on the stand and asked the guy in front of the jury whether he knew about the explosion in advance. In other words, whether it had been planned to set up the strikers. And that blew up the trial, and the guys were acquitted. So that's the kind of thing that's going on. And then, sticking with Bloomer, in 1938, there's a Federal Writers Project interview with one of the strikers. And he's not named, but the internal evidence indicates it was a guy named Eugene Peterson who was one of the leaders of the strike. And he tells the story that the company hired some of these deputies to blow up Bloomer's house, that there was a conspiracy to destroy his house. But because Vermont law enforcement circles are so small, Bloomer heard about it and was able to, and then got the names of the people who were supposed to blow up his house, called them up and said, if you do that, I'm going to prosecute you, and then got them to create affidavits to the effect that, yes, they've been asked to do this. The affidavits, I think, are lost. But it's an incredible story that the company is trying to blow up the house of the state's attorney to punish him for being pro-striker.
Let's go to the phones now. We've got Stephen joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just happened to be reading a book, The Quarriers, about the Fisk Quarry up in Islamont.
Oh, right.
And many years ago, it was going to be mined. And it's actually the stone in the state house comes from that quarry.
I think that's a slate quarry, that was earlier. If I'm not mistaken.
And in 1998, I held hearings, and it was determined that it was wetland.
Oh, interesting.
And so the quarrying operation had to stop, and the place was saved. And now it's a national monument. Both, there are two quarries there in Alamont. Anyway, it may be of interest. And it's a great book by Linda Fitch.
The Quarriers by Linda Fitch. Thanks for that, Stephen. Yeah. And,
it's
trip
a
up to
entendre. The Quarriers, meaning the warriors who saved the quarry.
Gotcha. All right. Thanks for that, Stephen. And that is a great trip up to Isle Lamont and see the Fisk quarry there. As a matter of fact, you pass Fisk Farm, which is where Teddy Roosevelt was when the president of the United States, Teddy was vice president when the president was shot. Very interesting place to visit. Let's talk about how this strike, Kevin, how long did it last? What wore the strikers down, and how did it end?
Yeah, it lasted. It started in November, and one of the first things that happened was that the strikers in West Rutland really was a union town, and they drove 4 miles up to Proctor at Thanksgiving weekend, Thanksgiving Day, and they marched through Proctor. And Proctor, which was controlled by the Proctor family, responded immediately. They banned marches that weekend. They had a special town meeting, banned marches. They hired more police, and they passed an ordinance that people standing around on corners, I think more than three people, constituted a crowd that could be broken up by the police. So they stamped on it right away. And that's how the strike started. And as we've indicated, it just got more bitter, and there was more violence. There was a riot in West Rutland. There was a case of a kid in Center Rutland who said something to a couple of sheriffs as they drove by, and they got out and beat him up, and then beat out his family when they came out to help him. So it just got worse, and then as the winter set in, the strikers really began to suffer. And they hung on through the winter of 1935, 1936, and then in the late spring, about May, people began to trickle back to work. And I think that the evictions were probably the decisive thing. And I also think the strikers probably had a feeling that they weren't going to win by that point as well.
Yeah. Now, I want to congratulate you, Kevin. You just received the Haber Edelman History Fellowship to work on this research. First of all, tell us about what the fellowship will allow you to do.
Thank you. I'm very, very appreciative and grateful to get it. It's a fellowship to do research at the University of Vermont's Silver Special Collections Library, which is an incredible resource for Vermont historians and has a terrific and extremely professional staff. So it allows a deep dive into those archives. This kind of support's incredibly important for Vermont historical research. This is the first year for this fellowship, and I think it's going to support much great work in the future.
How did you get interested in this particular strike of 1935?
Well, years ago, I had a teaching assistant, a guy named Scott McDowell, who was writing a master's thesis on it, and I didn't know much of anything. In fact, I don't think I knew anything about it at all, and Scott's thesis, which is on the legal aspects of the strike, which he wrote at UVM, was a terrific piece of historical work. So that got me very, very interested in it. And then the fact that I live in Rutland County, and that for years I've been going back behind the quarries, which is now the carving studio, the carving collective is back there. The last aspect was that I'm a fan of high school basketball, and Rutland and West Proctor have a particularly bitter rivalry. That always interested me, too. I wanted to know why.
Oh, that's great. How much information and records of the strike still exist?
Well, unfortunately, the company's records were damaged in a flood and then were purchased by the University of Pennsylvania, and they haven't finished cataloging them, and they're not available. So those are I don't even know what's out there still. But there are a fair number of records in Vermont repositories, such as Silver Special Collections Library. Then the local historical societies in Rutland County have records. There's some at the Vermont Historical Society. I found the West Rutland Historical Society to be particularly useful and helpful. But there's a lot of little a lot of little clues that have to be put together to tell the story.
Why is this important to research and to preserve what still exists about this, you know, one strike that lasted a number of months over 1935 to 1936?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons, Rick. One is that we have a self-image in Vermont, and certainly the way Vermont promotes itself is this kind of bucolic paradise that is somehow exempt from many of the unhappy things that happened in American history, and that's clearly not the case. This is a story of immigrants and immigrants being exploited and living extremely tough lives and workers fighting for rights and workers fighting to improve their lives. People, you know, come trying to make the future better for their children. It's a very moving struggle. It's a typical American story about how difficult it is to come from nothing and make your way. And the third reason I'd say is that these people helped build the U.S. Supreme Court. The legacy of the marble industry is very important. If you go into many cemeteries, national cemeteries, you're going to find marble headstones that are from Vermont. So this is a legacy that's very important to the state and that we need to keep alive.
Well, you mentioned the word image, and I did see an image that you were able to find of the strikers, but I understand there are still more images available somewhere that you hope to have access to.
Yeah, the Marble Museum in Proctor has a tremendous collection of plate glass negatives that I think are going to see the light of day relatively soon, and they're incredible resources. The Rowan Historical Society has some. The Proctor Historical Society, West Rutland has a really good collection, not particularly of images of people working in the quarries, but they have a great collection of images of the ethnic communities. The Polish Church in West Rutland had its own school. They had their own baseball team. They had a band. So the rich lives of the marble workers and their very particular ethnic communities. West Rutland had three different Catholic churches. A town of 3,000 people: a French church, an Irish church, and a Polish one. And that's part of the story, the assimilation, the difficulties in organizing people when they speak different languages. You know, at strike meetings in West Rutland, they'd have to have a Polish translator. So it's all part of a really typical but also very particular American story about labor and ethnicity.
And we have about 30 seconds left, but Kevin, any interest for this type of project from labor unions or fraternal organizations of Poles, Irish, French?
So far, no, but I've just been kind of working away in obscurity so far. I have a lot to learn, and I'd love to get more input from as many people as possible because these stories are out there. A lot of them are family stories, too, and you're not going to find those in archives.
Yeah. Kevin Thornton is an historian researching the strike at the Vermont Marble Company in November 1935. Kevin, thank you for always having wonderful Vermont history to share with us.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Thanks for being so interested.
All right. Take care. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to hear about hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And a reminder that coming up today at 11 o'clock, we have Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Following rugby teams in Australia, soccer clubs in Europe, I had heard of hyperbaric chambers and them being used to help players recover from injuries years ago. Some of the clubs even had them installed in their training facilities. The Lakers' LeBron James has been known to use hyperbaric oxygen therapy, as if that man needs to be any greater than he is. And then about a month ago, ads started running on WDEV for Hyperbaric Vermont. And the uses listed things like recovery from Lyme disease. So now I was really intrigued. And so joining me is Dr. Grace Johnstone. She's the founder and president of Hyperbaric Vermont. She's here to explain it all to us. Dr. Johnstone, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you very much, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Great having you. Listeners, to ask our Dr. Grace about hyperbaric oxygen therapy, or HBOT, or if you used it yourself, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Dr. Johnstone, what is that hyperbaric chamber?
Well, it's a device that lets us, because it's airtight, but we can provide oxygen inside it, it lets us increase the pressure that the person is in when they're in the chamber. And that has some really important effects in the physiology. Medically, you can affect a lot of things that under any other conditions just don't work.
So take me through what a person can expect during an HBOT treatment.
Well, you get into a chamber, and some of them are chambers that you can lie down in, and some are chambers you can sit in. It depends on the person's preference and how they're most comfortable. And the chamber will be closed. There are windows in it. You're breathing concentrated oxygen through a mask. You're fully clothed. You can read or, you know, watch something on your iPad or your phone. You can sleep or meditate, you know, whatever you feel is nourishing. And you're generally in for about an hour. And just as when you take off or land in a plane and you feel the pressure change, mm-hmm. you'll have that in the hyperbaric chamber as we pressurize it. And then once you've reached pressure, it feels completely normal. Just like in a plane, you don't know you're at lower pressure. You know, you can't tell really, except maybe your ankle swell. And then when the treatment is over, we will decompress the chamber slowly and let the person out. And in the meantime, all kinds of wonderful things will have happened in the physiology.
You must have known who you were talking to, because I did have a question about whether I could sleep in the chamber. So, touche, doctor.
People do. Yes.
Now, right. Does someone need a doctor's referral to be able to do this?
It is a prescription event. So a doctor needs to prescribe both the use of the chamber and the oxygen concentrator. Now, that's something that, you know, I can provide through our organization, or sometimes people come with prescriptions already, you know, referred from other doctors. Sometimes other doctors refer to us and I write the prescription. You know, most people do not know, most physicians really don't know much about hyperbaric. So that's a pretty typical arrangement as well.
Why is that required?
You know, I think the FDA has its finger in much of the healthcare pie, and mm-hmm. this is part of it.
Okay. Know? All right. So that's an FDA requirement.
Yes, it's an FDA requirement. Yeah.
Gotcha. All right. You said someone will generally be in for about an hour. Is that correct?
Typical. Yes. Yeah.
And then how often do people tend to come and get treatments?
It really depends on what condition they're interested in treating. You know, we have people who come in for a non-healing wound, say, who are on the verge of an amputation. We'll want to see them every day. They may be done in 2 weeks, you know. It depends on other situations, other conditions as well. Do they have diabetes? Are they a smoker? Then it will take longer, typically, for that wound to heal. Someone with a chronic condition may take a longer treatment time, but may need less frequency. Typically, though, it is something that at least initially in treatment one needs to do with some frequency. That could be twice a week or three times a week. As I said, if it's a real more of a crisis situation where we're trying to avoid an amputation, then we kind of ramp it up, right?
Mm-hmm. Are there any side effects to an HBOT session?
You know, most of the side effects that you read about, if you were to Google risks of hyperbaric, would apply to high-pressure systems. And those are necessary when you're dealing with, like, a scuba injury, you know, the bends.
Ah, right.
But what the new research, and by new, I mean the last 10 or 15 years, is really showing more and more clearly that the low pressures are equally effective and much safer. So for long COVID, for example, they're using that a lot internationally. They're using low pressures, such as what we use in our treatment centers. And those are very, very safe. You know, the things that we monitor for are like ear pain and pressure, which is something we can control because it relates to the chamber pressurizing faster than the person's ears can equalize. So mm-hmm. we can slow the chamber down. It's a very, very safe procedure.
When and how did you first become acquainted with hyperbaric oxygen treatment?
Oh, I had my own very intense adventure with Lyme disease, and that gave me meningitis, and then got down into my spinal cord and gave me a cord event that made it hard. I couldn't walk, basically, and I was in incredible pain, and the meningitis wasn't resolving, and, you know, I'd done sort of all the traditional IV antibiotics. This was going on for about a year, and I, you know, Vermont is so lovely, friend of a friend kind of thing. Someone whose daughter had almost died from Lyme had a chamber at home and heard about my situation and offered to let me try it. And that was the beginning of, one, my recovery, and two, you know, I'm now certified in hyperbaric medicine and have started this nonprofit to make care available to people who need it.
And, you know, when you heard about the chamber and someone suggesting that this might be helpful to you, did you have reservations? Were you skeptical at first about it?
You know, I was in a situation where I was in a high level of pain and had been for months. I was on hydromorphone. I couldn't function. I couldn't walk. I couldn't actually read because I had so much swelling around my brain that my eyes wouldn't track. I was at the point of, you know what, this isn't the life I want and nothing else is working. I was going to try it.
How long did it take for you where you could really feel that it made a difference?
You know, I think I was not typical of, you know, a lot of people don't feel things for a week or two. You know, the physiology has to change. But in my case, I went into the chamber with a really intense earache that I'd had for 9 months, and I could barely tolerate the pressurization. But when I got to pressure, I was okay. And when I got out, my earache was gone for the first time in 9 months.
Wow.
And so that was a good start.
All right, let's take a call from Fred, who's joining us from Newberry. Hi, Fred. Go right ahead.
So the standard air pressure is about 29.9. And so what would the air pressure in your chamber be?
Well, we generally measure this in what are called APA, or atmosphere absolute. And so we're going to 1.3 in our chambers. That is what the FDA, that's what all portable chambers go to in the U.S., the ones the Celtics travel with and the ones we have in our treatment centers and the ones you could have at home, for that matter.
So when you say 1.3, if would normal pressure be 1, what we experience all the time, and this would be
exactly.
A third more?
Yes, exactly. It's what, you know, we don't even think of ourselves as being at pressure, but yes,
right.
We consider normal pressure to be basically sea level. So we're not much above that here in Vermont.
All right. Fred, thanks for that question. Dr. Grace, what are the reasons people come to Hyperbaric Vermont for?
You know, there's a wide array, and I think it might be helpful to get just a brief rundown on what are the effects of hyperbaric, you know, why does this work?
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise it can sound like, my gosh, this works for everything.
Right.
And what are they saying, right? And so I think if we start with how does it work, what does it do, then we can look at, so what are the applications, you know? And I can summarize that pretty quickly, I think, in terms of those effects. Because increased pressure and increased oxygen levels have a really powerful anti-inflammatory effect. We can oxygenate all the body's fluid directly, cerebral spinal fluid, joint fluid, the fluid in the gut. And that has a really powerful anti-inflammatory effect. So that means we can inundate the brain with high levels of oxygen, for example, even if someone has had a stroke, if it's an area that doesn't have blood supply, or a large wound where there's not blood supply, but we can get the oxygen to the wound directly without relying on that. So the really high levels of anti-inflammatory effect is important. It's also a natural antimicrobial. And so this is important with any antibiotic-resistant infections, with candida, with Lyme and the co-infections, these things that can be really tough to get rid of. It's unique in that it speeds tissue healing and all types of tissue. You know, we tend to think of bone as needing one thing and skin as another thing and the liver as something else.
Mm-hmm.
But this speeds tissue healing in the brain and the skin and the muscles and the tendons and the ligaments. And that's kind of unique and important when someone's dealing with some really chronic or large trauma, you know, those kinds of issues. And it normalizes immune function. And this is also very unique. And important, makes it helpful with autoimmune conditions, but also things like long COVID and Lyme disease, where, you know, the Lyme organism will make parts of the immune system hyperreactive and suppress other parts of it. And it's part of why people get so sick from Lyme and why they're so vulnerable to other things as well when they have Lyme. You know, long term, we know that hyperbaric modifies gene expression. It upregulates anti-inflammatory changes and it downregulates inflammatory changes. And so when we look at just a natural antimicrobial speeding tissue healing and a powerful anti-inflammatory, the applications are wide. We're dealing with autoimmune issues for people. We're dealing with people who are dealing with diabetic conditions, non-healing wounds, retinopathies, chronic inflammatory conditions like fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, long COVID, infections that are hard to treat like candida and Lyme. Hyperbaric is unique in that it's the one thing that will stimulate radiation damaged tissue to heal.
Wow.
And so we deal with a lot of cancer patients who have had some injury from the treatment for cancer. It's also very good for a lot of the side effects of cancer treatments, like brain fog and nausea, fatigue. And so as a quality of life treatment, some people choose to do it while they're in the midst of chemo and radiation. And we coordinate that, of course, with their oncologists and all. We see patients who are dealing with cognitive impairment, who are dealing with stroke and brain injuries, concussions, because this stimulates the brain to heal in ways that we didn't even know the brain was capable of until, you know, outside of that environment. It just things that there aren't any medications that will do, and the brain is able to recover.
Wow.
So it's quite a wide net, you could say.
Yeah, you listed quite a few, and thank you for explaining why it does work. I'm going to pick one of them because I know someone who has suffered with this for decades now, and this is fibromyalgia. And and this is, I think, a nerve disorder that really affects a person and causes pain. So how does this HBOT treatment work with fibromyalgia?
Well, you know, fibromyalgia, along with some of these other conditions, really is a result of a systemic type of inflammation. So it's affecting, you know, not just the nerves and the muscles. There's often joint pain. There's often extreme fatigue. There can be nausea. There can be brain fog, headaches. There are the vasculature and the immune system are dysregulated. And so the hyperbaric works in your whole body's in there. That anti-inflammatory effect is working with all of those tissues and also helping the immune function and the central nervous system get back on track, you know, get off out of that dysregulated metabolism and back into a state where we have resilience again and normal plasticity. And that's important, you know, just as with the Lyme or some of these other chronic conditions, chronic fatigue. Yes, we want to stem the disease, relieve the symptoms, but we also need to restore that resilience and normal plasticity so that the person can really recover and not just have a wider window, you know?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Johnstone, we just had a listener who couldn't stay on the line but asked if it's ever been used for vertigo.
Oh, it certainly has. Vertigo, tinnitus. Yes, in fact, we have a couple of patients treating for that right now.
Wow. If someone's concerned or has questions about HBOT before they decide on a course of treatments, you know, what do you talk about? How do you convince them that this might or might not be the right treatment for them?
Well, you know, certainly for one, our website has a very good research page. It's hyperbaricvermont.org. But in our conversation, in our normal intake procedure, we would have that conversation where I would do a medical screening, a health history screening, looking at medications and what the conditions are that the person is interested in treating and what the history has been. They would have an opportunity to ask those kinds of questions. It's important because people, for the most part, don't know about this option in this country. You know, other countries are using it much more extensively, and it's just not part of our typical medical training here, and it's also not something that is on, say, TV, as, you know, most medications are.
Right.
So people don't know about it. Yeah.
We have about a minute left, and Doctor, looking at the chamber, I can see that people who are claustrophobic might have some issues. I think of an MRI as being similar. You know, is that an issue with people who consider using hyperbaric therapy?
You know, very, very rarely. Even amongst the people who are claustrophobic or have an issue, I would say 98% of the time we can make it work. And in part, I want to just, for perspective, an MRI is tiny. Lots of people have trouble in an MRI.
Right.
Our chambers, you know, we have a chamber that's 5 feet wide and 6 feet tall. You know, three of us can stand in it when it's inflated. When they're not under pressure, they look more like a saggy pup tent, you know. But we have a lie-down chamber that's about 40-inch diameter. You know, you can sit up in that.
All right.
So they're quite capacious, really, and I have to say that with a little coaching the first time, after someone's done it a couple times, it's old hat. They're in there, they're reading, they're watching a movie, they're taking a nap, you know?
Yep. There is a picture on the website that shows a woman in one of the chambers, and she looks so comfortable because there is plenty of room. So Dr. Grace Johnstone is the founder and president of Hyperbaric Vermont in Montpelier in South Burlington. And you can learn more at the website. It's hyperbaricvermont.org. Dr. Johnstone, I want to thank you so much for sharing this information about HBOT with us this morning.
Well, thank you again for the opportunity, Rick. It's really important for people and their providers to start learning about this and dealing with some of these tough conditions. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. You're welcome. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan and produced by Rachel Connor and Brady Jalili. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Send us those topics and suggestions for guests. You can also listen to the podcast of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading the podcast at wdevradio.com. You can subscribe there as well. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.